So in the interest of Rabbi Schoenfeld's schedule, I wish him mazel tov, first of all, on the recent wedding of his granddaughter. And he's coming from Shavuot Brachos, he's going to Shavuot Brachos. So I know usually the introduction is at the beginning, but the introduction will follow Rabbi Schoenfeld. Rabbi Schoenfeld will speak first so he can go back for the next set of Shavuot Brachos. We are very grateful to him to be here. He needs no introduction, but we are all grateful to him for everything he's done, certainly for all of us. Over many years, he has a long relationship, of course, had a long relationship with Rav Aaron Zatzal, and he has a lot to share with us, and many, many things, but he will share with us this evening his thoughts about Rav Aaron.
Well, first of all, Shavua Tov, and I came for a number of reasons. One is because the Gemara says, B'savin, Nikotin, B'savin, the Gadol. You turn somebody down who is not important, but never somebody who is. If Rabbi Hochma calls me, it's like a summons. As you heard in the middle of Shavuot Brachos for my granddaughter, and I'm certainly obligated and obliged, you say, to follow the request who has to do with Rabbi Lichtenstein. The last time we spoke about this family of the Ramzatzal, my dear, dear friend Julie Berman was my partner at the yeshiva when we had the commemoration of the 20 years of the Rav's Hisalka. So maybe it's coincidental or not that Julie's here tonight. One of the favorite sayings of the Rav Zatzal was the question he asked at Rosh Hashanah and Musaf, we quote the Navi, Kol Min Hashem, Habe Yakli Ephraim, Praise Ephraim, which is Yisroel. Midi Dabribo, Zoch Eskeraneel. Because I speak of him, I remember him. So the Rav said, it should be Fakert. I remember him, so speak of him. The Rav said, Midi Dabribo, says the Rav, with all good intentions. People just don't do that. If you want to keep up the memory of somebody, you have to speak of them as often as you can. Midi Dabribo, if I speak of them, in order for me to tell you something about Rav Lichtenstein Zichron Lebracha, I have to tell you a little story first, a true story, but the day have it over. Some of you may know that I am a so-called survivor. We're all survivors, but living in Vienna at the time, Hitler marched in on the Erev Shabbos, March the 12th, and that was the end, the beginning of the end. And we were able to escape after a few months of what we then thought was hell, compared to what was to follow, it was a grenade. But in any case, every survivor of one kind or another has a million stories to tell. And I would be sitting here for months, literally, to tell you stories of what happened to our family. Bechazi Hashem, we were able to get out. My father had to leave after a couple of weeks. My father was Secretary General of the Aguda. And the Aguda had a department called Help for Soviet Jewry, like today. Under the Stalin period, they were starving. And so the Aguda organized a drive to collect money to send to Russia in order to help those Jews. And it was called Russlandhilfe, help for Russia. The Nazis took this to mean communism. Now we had a neighbor downstairs, his name was Dr. Hans Melion. He was a doctor. He was a great Russian. Shabbos was the worst day for us, he used to come up, knock on the door. You Jews make too much noise, you sing and all kinds of things, you're disturbing my peace. Every Friday. Now when the Nazis came in, they came up, full dressed SS uniform, and we thought this is it. He said, look, we've been neighbors, not good neighbors. You Jews, not good neighbors. But we've been neighbors. So I have to let you know that I was appointed commissioner for this district to collect the names of Jews that they eventually to be sent to labor camp. He says to my father, "You are on the list, so get out." Again, long story, was able to get out. And my mother and my brother and I were left behind. And tried a way to get out. The Nazis gave you 3 months to get out, other than that point you have to stay. So my mother, Leah Shonen, found out that the country, Duchy of Luxembourg, would let Jews come in for 2 weeks, and then they would have to leave. So we found out we were able to get a visa to go to Luxembourg. My cousin and my aunt and I went first, then my mother and my brother followed. Eventually, we ended up in Paris, illegally, because the Jewish community of Luxembourg was very generous, a few hundred Jews only, and they collected money to bribe the train conductor that went from Luxembourg to Paris. So we got to Paris, we had family there, and we ended up eventually in a Jewish school called Ecole Maimonide, the Rambam school. Believe me, if the Rambam would be alive, would say, "Don't name it after me." Another kind of a school, but still, most of the students were French boys, and we had a handful of refugees from Vienna and from Germany. Some of you may know the Klugman family in Washington Heights, and others, we had in that school. I was very unhappy in that school, because these boys were not from boys, and it made life difficult for what they called the refugees, the refugees. They come here, they want this, they want that. At that time, my brother and I were trained to have Nagel bus in the morning. They come in the night and pour the water into our beds. It was a very unhappy time. There was one teacher there, and this is why maybe I came tonight. One teacher, himself a refugee, who picked up these few boys, like the Klugmans, my brother, myself, to give us chizuk. And to learn. Every morning before school began, and every evening, he took us aside and told us Chumash and Rashi. Bichlal gave us chizuk. And said, "Don't give up. Things will work out fine." And he saved our neshamas, truthfully speaking. And his name was Chil Lichtenstein. He was the father of Rabban. If it were not for him, I doubt very much whether my brother and I would slip on a twill today. Maybe I'm exaggerating. But he took us aside, spoke to us in German, a little bit in French. I remember one Shabbos, the chief rabbi of Paris came to visit the school. His name is Yehuda Rabban Liber. Liber, I got to say I'm a year to become a Frenchman. And he walks in, and the principal, name was Kohn, he moved to Haifa, introduced me to him. This is a young boy, at that time I was 15, came from Vienna, and his brother, and he's now in school. So I expected to say, "Well, wonderful that you're here." He said, "J'espère, I hope you're going to be a good Frenchman." Being who I am, innocent at the time, I said, "C'est pas vrai, it's not true. You have to be a good Jew." He says, "Yes, yes, but you have to be a good Frenchman too, it's the same thing." That was a kind of avira. If it had not been for Michiel Lichtenstein and his wife, Olea Shalom, there would have been great troubles for us until we were able to get out and ended up in England. This Chil Lichtenstein later became a teacher in Central School for Girls, I think, taught French. But the few hours that he spent with us every day in learning, giving chizuk, I made sure that our tefillin were put on right. He used to give us a shiurim and his tzitzis, how to want to do with tzitzis. Bechlal, there was a kind of chizuk and kirov work. A one-man care of team. There was another teacher, a Frenchman, Zelikovsky, was the same way. So if it had not been for him, life for me would have been totally different, I think. So I'm here tonight to celebrate his father's memory, the kind of man he was. The next time I met him was many, many, many years later in Yerushalayim. We have an apartment in Kataman, Rechav, Rabbi Ezra, and a davening in the Shtiblach, if you know the neighborhood, in Kataman. And that's where Rav Aaron lived. And he brought his father to shul every day. His father was blind at the time. If you want to know what kibbutz are for him, and you have to watch Rav Aaron and his father. Looked after him. Found the pages in the sinner for him. Other passages he read aloud, the father repeated it. And that quality of kibbutz are for him, you rarely see today. And I must tell you that in my own case, Baruch Hashem, I'm a little limited, as you can see. Our children, Baruch Hashem, all of them, fulfill this mitzvah. I can tell you, as a so-called old man, you appreciate when children come around. In this connection, the Rav once said, in Parshas Kedoshim, he's saying, Kedoshim to you, Ish imel vov tirov shabsosa tishmova. What's the connection? Rashi points out already that both of the Chaya, Chiyav, and Shmira Shabbos, all right? The Rav said, no. Shabbos is a wonderful day, said the Rav. No, you go to shul, Friday night, you sit zmiras, get filled with fish, the soup, the meat, depends if you're Litvak or Polish, different kind of fish, and Shabbos morning you go to shul, and it's a nice day, and you go for a walk with your parents, the kids come over, and get Shabbos day, get Shabbos Zedi, very nice, beautiful day. There comes a time when Shabbos says, you got to pay no free lunches. You work in a bank, wonderful job. Even Goldman Sachs, it's a wonderful job. And then they come along, we want to promote you to be vice president. Fine. But on a Friday night, I can't come in. Well, that's different. How many jobs are lost? Shabbos says, I want to be paid, back. Shabbos is a wonderful day, but it does not come for free. Shabbos demands a price. The Rav kibbutz are for him. It's a nice thing. Hey, Pop, what are you doing this afternoon, Sunday? I take you for a ride to the park. Take you to a ball game. Whatever you want to do then. Oh, it's a nice day tomorrow. I have a party in my house. Please come, I'll pick you up. Great. Comes the time, says the Rav, the Tatav at Altenkrank. And you need help. Moshe, can you come and take me to the doctor? Oh, I would love to, but I'm appointed my accountant. I'm just going to make it. Maybe Harry can do it. Okay. Harry, Dad, it's great, but did you know an appointment with my accountant and my business partner? They're not around. Kibbutz Av V'Em is the same story. Beautiful mitzvah. Pleasant mitzvah. But there comes a time it demands a price. That's why the Chumash says, Ish imi v'vav teroi v'shapsoi satishmah. That's the tzara shavet between the two. And I must tell you, I saw Rav Aaron. My friendship with Rav Aaron, if I can call it that, is due to some extent to his father. Obviously, I was in Rav Shir, but I came from England to YU, I should say to Leeds, and I was put in the Rav Shir, Rav David Lipschitz Shir, and for me, the Rav Shir was, what should I say, not pleasant. No, I learned Rabbi Lenapian, Shevitz Chaim, I learned, you know, I got in the learning. But I couldn't get used to the whole style of learning. There's one young man at the time, also saved me, Rabbi Joseph Gold, from Worcester. He's also not here with us. Came over to me, hey, like me! What are you sitting here? I'll be your chavrusin. So this kind of personal relationship. Rav Aaron was the youngest Talmud in the Shir. I was the oldest, I was married, had two children at the time. And we sat in terror. We had a few boys, two were called Schoenfeld and Scheinfeld, and one was called Schulman, Chaim Schulman. But the Rav would say, no, Zog the Gemara, I'm afraid, not me, hope not me. Until he came out with the words. And the only ones who were able to argue with the Rav was Joe Gold, Chaim Shulman, and Lavan. Lavan, I think, was 10 years younger than him. And Mateo, he did not give the Rav a free pass. No way. And the Rav got upset when they were learning Nidin the course. He said, Lechtenstein, you're Zokos, you're not an Eloi, right? You're saying it's an Eloi. He says, I was an Eloi too. Nothing happens to Elohim. It's what God is saying. Look at me, he said. And then I spoke to Tova last week, and she said, yeah, my husband at the time in the Shia in the Gemara in Wayu, and got the Rav to the point, says, Lechenstein, Lamach Shalab, leave me alone already with your questions. That's just the way he was. So I'm here tonight simply to stress that this great Rabban, he was a teacher of my daughter Aviva at Stern College in English Literature, to learn from him Kibbud Avraham. That is the main reason I came here today, to speak about his father and the way he treated his father. That was a great thing, this Kibbud Avraham to him. You had to watch him in the Shtiblach and Kataman, in the room to sit, and the 5 million at the same time, when something was said, you're from Lord, the other says, you know, it's very difficult. He sat with his father, guided him to a seat, opened the siddur for him, took his finger, and told him where we want. That's what I saw in practice, mitzvah of Kibbud Av for him. So when you got this call, an opportunity to let you know about his father. I don't know if anybody here knew his father, but that's what his father was. When my grandson, Moshe Pinchon, was a Gush for 15 years, got married, I said, you know, you must start the Kiddushin. Rosh Hashiva is Ravar. He was Novelis at the time. We went to his house, and he said, first of all, I'm a Novelis. So it's a problem. Secondly, he said to my grandson, you have a grandfather, Rabbi Shomfer, you're asking me? Of course your grandfather should be Misad the Kiddushin. These were some of the traits, and in the Shiva was known as the babe, I don't know if you remember, and he remembers this. The reason to say some because he was the youngest. He said, no, he was an expert in statistics at baseball. And he knew how many home runs Babe Ruth hit, and what the which ball, and which inning, and he knew all the statistics. So I'm here tonight, you requested me to come. And I owe it to tell you, of all the godless, the gedulim, the mitzvah of Kibbud Av V'Em, when the Gemara says, Kabed Eser V'Echo, V'Eser V'Echo, was the word Es L'Rabbas Achamise. Not even lifetime Achamise. And at this point, we have to mention them. His father's no longer here, he's no longer with us, Nishmosim Beidin. And I thank you, Rabbi Rochberg, for the opportunity I had to point this out, because I don't know his biography, his tradition just came out. Like I said about his parents. His parents is where he came from. And he paid them back as much as he could when they kind of the mitzvah of Avraham. The big lesson from a godly Yisrael. But thank you very much for listening. You have to forgive me if I go back to the Sheva Brachos. I wish you all Shavua Tov. A good tovach, a gesund tovach, and bracha v'atzlach at all of you.
Thank you very much. By the way, some of us, including myself, had Rabbi Phil Lichtenstein as a teacher in BTA also. I learned Dikut from him and also a few books of Tanakh.
Please forgive me, I'm done with to show disrespect. I'm not hit in the run, but...
Officially welcome. I would like to first of all extend thanks just to Zev Berman and Avi Feiler for helping to plan the evening. Special thanks also to Rav Moshe Rosenberg, who is actually with us from Congregation Eitz Chaim, who joined together an evening and recommended also the combination with Yom Yerushalayim to recognize Yom Yerushalayim. Some of us might remember Rav Aharon Zatzal speaking about Yom Yerushalayim in 501 many years ago, in room 501, the fifth floor, first hall. So you can get that. I'm sure it's on YU Torah also. We'll publish somewhere. I'd like to also thank, of course, the speaker senior, Rabbi Schoenfeld, who spoke already, Rabbi Menachem Penner, a local Rabbi Mordechai Young Israel of Hollywood, soon to be Rabbi Emeritus and Dean of Reitz, who was a Talmud in Gush of Rav Aharon, Rabbi Julius Berman, who was our own member and, of course, prominent international leader for the Jewish people for many, many years, friend of Aaron from his days in yeshiva a long time ago and ever since. And Aaron, of course, we've been zocher to have Aaron in the neighborhood sleeping a few times since the Berman's moved in. And last, Rabbi Chaim Rosenzweig, Rosh Yeshiva and Rosh Kollel, Baron Kollel Elyon, and also Talmud of Aaron at Gush. Those are the speakers this evening, and we'll get to them shortly. Just a few brief remarks. One, the first time I saw Rav Aaron Lichtenstein that I remember was I went into the third floor Beis Medrash in First Hall when he was a Rosh Kollel. I was a freshman or perhaps a sophomore in YU, and I went in and I was looking around and I saw a few different things. And I saw, Rav Shechner and Rav Willig were studying B'Chavrusa on one table with each other. But in the front, Rav Aaron was standing, and he was learning, and he was learning B'Chavrusa with himself. He would stand, and he would face this way, and he would say what he said. And then he would turn and face this way and say what he said. It was kind of a remarkable experience, because what's the purpose of Chavrusa? The purpose of Chavrusa is to make sure that you're finding the truth, and you're not too biased in your own opinion. But Rav Aaron somehow is able to always express both sides of everything, and this is anybody who's a Talmud knows that he had the what they called in Israel when I visited shortly after he went to Gush. One of my friends told me, "Hey, Ma'avimot Hadarash Shostei of Shariot." Everything is about the possibilities, and it's a very unique characteristic. You have to look at something from two different ways. He looked at Gemara that way, Rashi that way, Tosfos that way, life that way. I assume he also looked at Milton and all of those other, you know, literary experts the same way. Everything was always a varied way to look at things, and I think that very much enabled him to be the gadol that he was for all of us. Of course, we know he blended Torah, Mada, Chachma, and literature. I was zochet to have him as my Rebbe in my junior and senior year at Yeshiva College, before I went to Israel to learn. And I remember a few things that one I shared with the Rebbe, with the members of the shul. I'm not going to share that with you, but I will share the following. I remember after the first, they didn't have report cards, but there was a grade. So when he would give a grade, I don't really understand how this worked, because I teach at Stern, you give a grade, it's on a computer, you just put the grade in. There's no paperwork or anything. But in those days, I guess there was some kind of paperwork. I don't remember how the paperwork was, but I know that he wrote a note on the grade. So he wrote a note on the grade. And what the note was, I don't remember. That's probably a good thing. But the result was my father, Zichron Levracha, came to meet with Rav Aaron after Shir one day because he wanted to understand what it was Rav Aaron wrote in the grade. So I'm in college ready. I'm a junior or senior in college ready. It didn't make a difference. So that told you a little about my father. It told you also about Rav Aaron. Rav Aaron didn't say, "Why are you coming? He's in college. He's an adult. He's on his own." Rav Aaron understood if a father wants to come and talk about his son learning, what could be more important? And if there's some way to improve somebody's learning, that's what it's all about. And he, I think, really worked very hard not only to teach his Talmidim, but to understand every Talmud, to relate to every Talmud on their own level. Fast forward many, many years. To about 7 or 8 years ago, I was president of the Rabbinic Council of America, and we had many people to turn to, but frankly, the one single person to turn to about issues that were at hand and are still at hand was Rav Aaron Zechasach Levracha, and he would give time not only to me as a Talmud and the president of the RCA, but he would give time to anybody who needed. If you listen to any of the eulogies over, or Askaros, or any kind of remembrances over the last few weeks, you know that this is like a recurring theme. Whoever needed time to talk to him, he would talk to them. And the things that I talked to him about, frankly, were issues affecting the modern Orthodox Jewish community. And how does the RCA as a national organization relate to different issues that are going on? So I can't like share with you like this issue, that issue, but the global picture is the following. What do you do, how do you react when someone is maybe stepping over the bounds one way or the other? What do you do with that individual, organization, whatever it is? How do you deal with that? And he was extremely, I'll say, firm in his halachic opinions about what is mutter and what is asur. And everybody can have their opinions and so on. His opinions were not based upon a dogma, but rather on analysis of all the possibilities. And at the end of the day, if he felt someone was outside halachic boundaries, he said, it's not allowed. But he also said, but you have to do everything you can to try and make sure that they stay in with us. And that was a very, very important educational principle, and it goes deep into what his character was about, and that was he was an Ohev Yisrael. He just loved every single Jew. He was like Aaron HaKohen, Ohev Yisrael Mekaven LaTorah. His kiruv to the Jewish people at large, people in the yeshiva, people non-yeshiva, people in all realms of Jewish society, was based on the fact that he loved each and every Jew, and his goal was to make sure that the Torah of Hashem would be promulgated, but also that the level of every single Jew in the world could be elevated. He was very cognizant also, I say, of the world at large. He understood issues. We know he was bothered by things that went on. If he felt that, we'll say, Jews were not doing the right way, or Israelis were not doing the right way, he would speak out, although it's not typical for him to speak out on those kind of issues, unless he felt it was very crucial for the betterment of the Jewish people. We are gifted this evening to have, as I said, three other speakers. One of the, I think, challenges of speaking about someone of the greatness of Rav Aaron is that in many ways he was like a diamond, and a diamond has shivim panim. And it's not like shivim panim l'Torah, but a diamond has many facets. And every single individual who knew Rav Aaron Zatzal would see the facets that they saw, but every single angle that you looked at him was an angle which would give us light and give us, if you will, very much chizuk and elevate us to try and aspire to a higher level. When he came to see Rav Aaron, and I heard this word and it really bothered me, people would say they were afraid to go and speak to him. And I know what they mean, but that's definitely the wrong word. There was trepidation. Why? Because you wanted to make sure that you asked the question in a way that was intelligent. Because he would analyze the question, he would have high expectation of you. So it wasn't, there's no fear, because he would never have any possible negative reaction to anything you said. He would be probing, but he would be elevating at the same time. And so, this evening also, for me, is a meeting of trepidation, knowing that it's impossible to give proper kavod to someone who was our Rebbe. When I say our Rebbe, I don't mean only my Rebbe and the Rebbe of those who were zocheh to be in his class, but all of Klal Yisrael really are his students, in many, many ways, the same way as the students of Aaron HaKohen. I will stop my remarks now. Yehi Zichro Baruch. We should all be zocheh to learn the lessons of his life and bring them into our own lives and good health for many, many years to come. Rabbi Menachem Penner.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Hochberg, and thanks for organizing this event. I don't know, I was terrified. I don't know about anybody else. but I guess that's the way that a person feels when they're in front of someone who is so great. I remember sitting in the shir, and we would be terrified as they speak about the generation before me of being in the Rav's shir and being called on. And when Rav Lichtenstein would call on you, he'd actually call on you in a way that, in a very open-ended way very often. He'd look around the crowd, and there would be some of us Shana Bet Americans who, even if we had an answer, we'd be terrified to say it in Hebrew in front of the Shana Hey Israelis there. And he would just say, Penner, ma ta choshev? What? I don't know, I'm sitting in front of a little dude. What do I think? What do I think? I think you're giving a good shiur. What am I going to say? Rav Lichtenstein's anivus, the rabbis tell us that you see HaKadosh Baruch Hu, lahavdil, you see HaKadosh Baruch Hu is where you see his godless, is where you see his anivus. And anivus is what allows us to see godless. Those of you who know me, I'll speak in a very personal way. As one of the younger Talmidim of Lichtenstein, in a certain sense, those of you who know me well know that I'm not always in the best of health. So that didn't start when I became a rabbi. It started already when I was learning. And during Shana Bet, I was in Rav Lichtenstein's shir for a while, and then I took ill for quite some time. So I was laying in bed, and I'd spent quite a few weeks in my room. And in those days, we didn't have cell phones. We did have pay phones. And the deal was that every 3 weeks, my parents were going to call me on the payphone. Every 3 weeks, I think it was like Tuesday at 1:30, something like that, and that was just the deal. I knew to be down there and pick up the phone. So I had a high fever. I wasn't thinking about anything. And my parents called. I hadn't been in Rav Lichtenstein Shir for a couple of weeks, and I didn't really know whether he noticed I wasn't there or didn't notice I wasn't there. So one day I get a knock on the door, and the message was that I should call my parents very quickly. What happened? My parents, a regular phone call. And of course, Rav Aaron, as was his way, he picked up the payphones when they rang. It's an extraordinary thing. Wilkenstein picked up the payphones, which was to the horror of many of the Gush students, who was the only way to contact, they were all of marriageable age, to contact their girlfriends. And Wilkenstein would routinely pick up the phone. What was amazing about it was that he would pick up the phone not because it was an act of chesed. You know, I could imagine going past the phone and thinking like, oh, this is a way to help somebody. Rav Lichtenstein answered the phone for one reason, because there was no reason not to. So what if he was Rav Aaron Lichtenstein? You have the phone's ringing, you answer the phone. So what if you're the Rosh HaYeshiva? You answer the phone. So my parents called. They said, how are we calling for Mark Penner? Who's this? Aaron Lichtenstein? And they said, oh, that's very nice. He said he was very much enjoying your shiur. So actually, he hasn't been there for 3 weeks. And as I said, the next thing was a knock on my door and said, Rav Lichtenstein answered the phone, call your parents now. I grew up, my entire existence was to be in Rav Lichtenstein's shiur. All my rabbeim in high school had learned by Rav Lichtenstein, and that was what my career was, to my learning career was to do, was to be able to sit by Rav Lichtenstein. I even stayed in YU the first year after college for a year, because I knew that way for sure I'd be able to get into Rav Lichtenstein's year before my parents wrote me back into coming back to America. That way I was a year ahead. And yet I had never met Rav Lichtenstein. I wasn't particularly aware of who the greats were in our community. And in 12th grade, I went to look at yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. And I went to look at the Gush. I had actually never, well, I couldn't look him up on the internet, whatever. I had never seen Rav Lichtenstein. I didn't know who he was. And I'm coming down to lunch in the Chadar Ochel. And as I'm about, you know, it's a lot of Talmidim coming in together into the line, and everybody's kind of making their way in, and somebody yanks my arm. I almost took out my left arm. Because I had almost cut Rav Lichtenstein on the line for lunch. I have to tell you that first impression of someone who had become such a mentor, that it didn't dawn on me that this person who was standing online in the lunchroom, who was there without a beard, who was there without a tie, and who was just literally waiting online in the Chadar Ocha with the rest of the Talmidim, to imagine that this was Rav Lichtenstein, didn't dawn on me that that could be. I shouldn't cut anybody, I guess. But you know, you're talking to somebody. Rav Lichtenstein's greatness, I really believe, could be seen. I can't describe his greatness. I'm not at a level, I'm not at a place to tell you what his greatness was. But I could tell you why we could see it. And the reason why we could see it was because there was no ego there that would get in the way. There was no ego there that blocked us to be able to see who he was and to be able to see before whom he was standing. To be with Rav Lichtenstein was to be with someone who had an acute awareness that the Ribono Shel Olam was there. Every action was calculated. Every move of his body was calculated. And yet, sometimes somebody can be so great that you actually can't see what's behind them. I mentioned this in yeshiva a few days after he passed away. Our rabbis tell us that the greatness of David HaMelech was that he could project the greatness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu without getting in the way. We're told that Malchus Beis David is Nimshalo LeLavano. Why is David HaMelech? Why do we say David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kai? Why do we say that at Kiddush Levana? Because you know what's the hardest thing about being a king? If you're a Jewish king, if you're a Melech B'Yisrael, You have all this glory, you have all this power, and yet your role is to be invisible so that through you people could see the Ribono Shel Olam. And if you look at the rise and fall of the kings, at the transfer from Shaul to David and the kings as they go on, it's very true that a Melech B'Yisrael had an almost impossible job to be great himself and yet to have your ultimate goal to be invisible so that people could sense who's right behind you. Ein yeshiva ba'azara el lamalchei beis David bilvad. Nobody else could sit in the azara. You can't sit in azara. It looks like, right? The famous Gemara in Chagiga talks about matatron sitting up in Shemayim. If somebody sits before the Ribono Shel Olam, so it makes you think, chas v'shalom, there's more than one entity here. Ein yeshiva ba'azara el lamalchei beis David bilvad, because the essence of a true melech from beis David was to be able to be there and to have you, despite that, sense not him, but what was behind him. That's Malchus. And that's what I felt like sitting in front of Rav Lichtenstein, sitting in front of him in Shir Yomi. It was a sense that you could really detect, you could really feel, that if he was in the presence of the Ribono Shel Olam, and you were in his presence, that you were in the presence of the Ribono Shel Olam. I'll never forget seeing Rav Lichtenstein's face after one Yom Kippur. After Rav Amital finished Ne'ilah, two of them stood about 5 feet apart. And I'll never forget seeing Rav Lichtenstein's face, just the radiant joy, like the Levana. Mamish, you saw something from, I felt like I saw something from a different world. The pure, simple joy that he had made it through a Yom Kippur. The joy on his face. And to see the presence somehow, to see the Shechina shining in that way. I don't know, and I can't describe what Rav Lichtenstein's greatness was. But I can tell you that without that anava, we wouldn't have been able to notice it. We wouldn't have been able, it would have blocked everything else. And that's how we felt sitting before him. Now the Gemara says in today's daf, that when Rebbe was dying, Rebbe told one of his dying words was, "Vahoshivu yeshiva la'achar shloshim yom." That the yeshiva should go back into session after 30 days. It was amazing. That was there seemed to be a move to have even longer than 30-day memorial period for Rebbe, where the yeshivas were going to be out of session. And Rebbe said, "Moshe Rabbeinu got 30 days, so I also should get 30 days. That's the most, the maximum you could do for me is 30 days." And the Gemara says that in the morning and night, Tchlosin Yomin, Saftin B'Yamama V'Lelia. For 30 days, the yeshivas were by. Can you imagine this? It wasn't like one afternoon. For 30 days straight, they just said Hespedim, they didn't learn Torah. And then after 30 days, for the rest of the year, they spent half a day with Hespedim and half a day with learning Torah. How could you rationalize that? But sometimes from the hespedim of a great person, you can sometimes get even more than you can from just a blat gemara. Sometimes they probably, in hearing the stories about Rebbe, in hearing who he was, in hearing his godless, they took 30 days off from learning Torah. But they were probably inspired and uplifted in a much greater way. I continue as I hear more stories of Lichtenstein to simply be uplifted, to feel very lucky that I was able to be counted amongst his many, many Talmidim, to feel very lucky that my own Rabbeim pushed me to be able to sit in his shir and to have a real Matan Torah experience of my own. Yehi Zichro Baruch.
By Julius Berman.
Shus Marina Rav, Marella Paisai. How do you describe, in a few words, Avraham Lichtenstein, Zachenu Tzadok Lebracha. Brilliance as a Torah scholar, a pedagogue beyond compare, extraordinary piety, courage, and selflessness, clarity of vision and purpose. His level of intellectual honesty was matched only by his quest for emes, a man of true humility and integrity. The former chief rabbi of Britain, Lord Jonathan Sacks, described Rav Aaron as, I quote, a man of great intellect, equally at home in the literature of the sages and of the world, and a master Talmudist, a profound exponent of Jewish thought, a deep and subtle thinker, who loved English literature, and whose spiritual horizons were vast. But candidly, I'm not here to talk about that. Certainly not this evening. I leave to others, more literate and erudite than I, to dwell on these attributes of this unique, very, very unique, multifaceted personality. It is on the next sentence by the chief rabbi that I want to focus for a moment. Quote, no less impressive was his stature as a human being, caring and sensitive in all and to all his relationships, one who honored his fellows even when he disagreed with them, a living role model of Jewish ethics at its best. It was 1958, a mere 57 years ago, and we were in the shir of the Rabban Shel Yisrael, Marena Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik Zecheinu Tzadik Livracha. We were learning Masechta Shabbos. An event took place that would make its mark in the history of the yeshiva, and I believe in the Torah world in general. It started with a rumor. Someone mentioned in the Beis Medrash that he had heard that the Babe was returning to yeshiva from Harvard, having received his PhD there. Who was the Babe? The old-timers told us he was Babe Lichtenstein, the young Ilui from Chaim Berlin, but now a full-fledged Gaon in the truest sense of the world, of the word. Indeed, he was already a legend. Moreover, what is equally relevant to me at least, he was a Gaon in Midos. Looking back as the years went by, if we could only learn to emulate his conduct as he interacted with people, whether it was his late parents that I personally observed, with generations of his family, with in-laws, with Rosh Yeshiva, with any and every human being that has an occasion to meet him, we would all be richer for it. I must say a word about his relationship with his parents. Many of you have experienced it themselves. Most of you are aware, may have even experienced, the unique, almost mesiras nefesh of Rav Aaron for his father, when the latter was blind and almost stone deaf, how Rav Aaron sacrificed his own tefillah, in a sense, to allow his father to mekayim his chi of tefillah, whether or not he had one under his physical condition. That behavior has become part of the living legend of Gush. What few know, however, is the kibud av va'em by Rav Aaron that long preceded his father's sickness. When Rav Aaron and Tova went on Aliyah to Israel, his parents were not quite ready to leave America. So Rav Aaron requested that I act somewhat as a surrogate with his parents in the meanwhile. Thus I had the schia of meeting with his parents relatively frequent during a short period of time. But let me tell you, the overwhelming nachas ruach his parents had derived from Rav Aaron throughout the years was simply indescribable. To listen to them talk about their son, their young son, you would feel that they were living in Olam Haba, although it was still Olam Hazeh. During the week of Shiva, when I approached the home, of course, as one would expect, it was crowded and overflowing. But this time it was a bit different. A delegation of Arab workers at the yeshiva came to the Shiva house to pay their respects, to express in their way their sense of loss of a man who always treated them with respect as fellow human beings, who would go out of his way, at least prior to the Yom Tovim, to visit them and express the gratitude of the yeshiva and his own personally for all they did for the students of the yeshiva to make their year of study that much more comfortable. I honestly believe that I can say without equivocation, the Rav Aaron fell within the very select group of Talmidei Chachamim that qualified to be allowed into the Beis Medrash of Rav Gamliel, because, as the Gemara Bracha says, Tocho Kiboro, his inner character fully corresponded to his exterior. Returning to 58 and the impending return of Rav Aaron to the yeshiva, I was also warned, and you heard it before, that I shouldn't be misled by his easygoing, friendly nature. On the basketball court, he was a terror, especially under the basket. His elbows were sharp, and he played rough. Honest, but like everything he did, played to win. What a change he made in the class. While on the one hand, he was intentionally laid back and tried to blend into the rest of the class, rarely volunteering on his own, on the other hand, it wasn't long before we realized that this student was clearly different. Whenever the Rav was searching for a citation, he would look to Rav Aaron, who would immediately respond with chapter and verse. It soon became clear he was a walking encyclopedia Talmudist. Many have referred to Rav Aaron's humility and integrity. Others have described his acts of chesed and kindness. And I'm confident we can spend all evening plus just skimming the surface of the kindness he has exhibited through the years. And yet, and I say this most respectfully, I don't consider these acts chesed at all. To my mind, an act of chesed is an act that is something that is beyond the teva, l'mayla min teva, something that is a bit or a lot out of the ordinary, not necessarily expected in the normal course of conduct. But whose normal are we talking about? Certainly not Rav Aaron's. In his normal, kindness was integral. Chesed was not l'mayla min teva. It was part and parcel of his very teva, as if it was in his genes. A small, very small incident. My brother-in-law, a Talmud of Rav Aaron yet before he went on Aliyah, had arranged to have a pair of tefillin, in effect, written for his son's future bar mitzvah in Gush. When the tefillin were finished, the arrangement was made that the sofer would bring the tefillin to Rav Aaron at Gush, and Rav Aaron and his daily trip back to Yerushalayim, where he lived, would take it back with him to his home, and my brother-in-law would pick him up from the house. Unfortunately, on the day chosen for the delivery to Rav Aaron, it was raining cats and dogs, a real mabul. That afternoon, my brother-in-law, who was in the hotel in Jerusalem, hears a knock on the door. He opens it, and there stands Rav Aaron, appropriately wet from the rain, with a tefillin in hand. My brother-in-law, feeling very uncomfortable, said that the understanding was that he was to go to Rav Aaron's house to pick up the tefillin, not the reverse. Rav Aaron nonchalantly responded that he had to get wet anyway, going from yeshiva home, so why should both of them get wet? Simple logic, right? That was Rav Aaron. On the other hand, try to be nice to him. A chesed, even a simple kindness to Rav Aaron, it was nearly impossible. Before his son Yitzi moved to Muncie, Rav Aaron would stay at our house when he came to New York. The routine surrounding Rav Aaron's trips to New York two or three times a year, would usually follow a familiar pattern. About a month before the trip, the calls would start coming in at home, first sporadically, then accelerating as the trip approached. The caller heard the Ravarn would be arriving soon, and he or she or they wished to make an appointment with him to discuss a personal matter. If Ravarn had been contacted in Israel, he would usually suggest that they call my wife Dottie, who was president of the Etzion Foundation at the time, to arrange a meeting. Of course, Dottie had no control over Ravarn's schedule whatever, and she knew that much of his schedule needed to be flexible to accommodate additional tasks such as giving shiurim at the yeshiva, especially for Gush alumni, interviewing prospective applicants to Gush for the post-high school year or years, giving community lectures, delivering Orthodox Forum essays, and the like. Under those circumstances, how Dottie was able to juggle the schedule is beyond me, and I wisely, very wisely, stayed out of that area of activity. Finally, the time came, and Ravarn arrived in America. He would take the late-night flight from Lod and arrive early in the morning. Upon arrival, he would pick up his large suitcase from baggage claim, and together with his carry-on containing talis and tefillin and the sperm he'd need on the trip while others slept, he would take a taxi directly to the shul that I davened in at the time in Forest Hills. Usually, when I came into shul, he was already there. After shul, as we were leaving, I would go over to take the suitcase to the car, but I never succeeded. Invariably, he would insist on taking the suitcase himself. This would happen time and time again. I didn't have the nerve to tell him that I was personally embarrassed, because people would see both of us walk out of shul, he with a large suitcase and heavy carry-on, and me with a set of car keys. That's bad enough. Can you imagine that someone might even assume that Ravarn was carrying my suitcase? Once we arrived home, Ravarn felt very comfortable. He knew exactly where his room was, the setup in the library for him to work at either an article for the Orthodox Forum series with which he was continually involved, or preparing one or more shiurim that he will be delivering while in New York, usually at the yeshiva, but sometimes in addition in a community setting. The problem for me, anyway, was in the kitchen. Dottie, knowing what Ravarn eats and drinks and what he doesn't eat and drink, had fully prepared the breakfast, so that was a non-issue. The complication arose when he finished eating. Ravarn insisted on washing every dish, every plate, and utensil he used, returning the uneaten food to the proper place, leaving the kitchen spotless. While my wife naturally was thankful, I was not. What a terrible example he was giving. After breakfast, I went off to work at the law firm, and sometimes Dottie had to leave for a short while to stop or to shop or keep an appointment. That left Ravarn all alone working on whatever he was working on, the lecture of this year. But now he had another task, answering the phone. Imagine the scene, if you will. The phone rings, Ravarn answers. Sometimes it's for Ravarn and that works out well. But if it's not, the caller's perplexed. He knows the number he called, but he doesn't recognize the voice. So he asks, "Julie?" And Ravarn answers, "He's not home." The caller, the obvious question follows, "Who is this?" Answer, "Aaron Lichtenstein." Dead silence. The caller is nonplussed. It takes a while until finally Ravarn says, "Can I take a message?" When my wife comes home, our temporary telephone operator dutifully reports to her all the messages. So tell me, folks, how many of you can afford such a high-priced message telephone operator? I've learned from Ravarn that true friendship may go well beyond the usual social relationship of people. At times, a true friend can even divine the need of a friend and decide on his or to do a kindness, even a major kindness, without being asked. My father, Zal, was niftar on Asar B'Tevis at the end of 1987. The kvura was to be in the cemetery of Yeshivas Panovich in Bnei Brak, as arranged many years before by my father at the suggestion of our cousin, Rav Shlomo Berman, Rosh Yeshivin Panovich, the son-in-law of the stipler. When Rav Aaron was informed of the p'tira, he on his own went to pick up two of my father's grandchildren attending yeshiva at the time, Gush, my son Eli and my nephew Ari, and brought them to the airport to be malavid my father to Bnei Brak. There they stopped in front of the yeshiva. Scores of the yeshiva bachurim came out to greet them, and at the request of another cousin of mine, Rav Aaron was masvid my father, following which they proceeded to the cemetery for the kvura. I need not tell you the substance of the hesped, although I recall it vividly, but that does not fit into the job description I was given tonight. Of course, shortly thereafter, Rav Aaron Kedarka Bekoda showed up at the Hakamas HaMaseva and again was masvid my father. There were other such incidents, and you will hear and have heard many of them before and many of them in the future, but that's enough of my personal vignettes. Let me conclude with a relevant Torah I once heard from the Rav Zatzal. He pointed out that one could not frame a better job description for a manhig than Moshe himself in responding to his father-in-law's reprimand about Moshe's daily schedule in Chumash Mos. Ki Elohem davar ba'ilai. This is Moshe describing his job. When they have a matter, they come to me, says the Rav. That is the manhig engaged in chesed. Whatever it might be, a personal problem, a family issue, sometime intergenerational disputes, whatever the nature of the issue, that, says the Rav, is the manhig as the Baal Chesed. But Moshe goes on. The Shafati ben Ishu ben Re'ehu, and I judge between a man and his fellow, says the Rav, that is the manhig as a posik, whether purely halachic issues or as a dayan involving disputes between people and resolving them. That's the manhig, as I say, as a posek or a shofet. And finally, Vodati eschukei Olakim ve'estorosav. And I make known, I teach the decrees of Hashem and his teachings. That, said the Rav, is the manig in his role as Malamed or Rosh Yeshiva. The Rav then went on to list a series of manhigim throughout the years and point out with respect to each what his specific character was proficient in. Ashrei Hador. Fortunate is the generation that has the ultimate tzchiya to have as its manig, as its mora derech, a man that in his composite personality combined all three of the attributes described and prescribed by Moshe Rabbeinu for manhigus, the Baal Chesed, the Posek, and the Rosh Yeshiva. Proficient in each, but always the warm, engaging, approachable, pleasant, cordial human being, suffused with humility and integrity. Rav Aaron represented all of our dreams of what Torah could mean in our lives. May his memory inspire us to live in his shadow, to dream of his greatness, and continue to be inspired by his living lessons to be a ben or bas Torah as the first step on the path to the ultimate goal of being an Eved Hashem. Chaval al da'avdin v'lomashem.
Be
Before the last speaker, just recognize Rudolf Weinberger of local Kalbe Sisak of Jamaica States, David Keane of New York Hospital of Queens. We are zochet to have Rabbi Michal Rosenzweig give shiur here every Monday night at 8:30 Gemara, so if you want to join any Monday night, please feel free to do so. We're zochet also he agreed to speak this evening. Certainly we all recognize that he is the epitome in many ways of what all aspire to be Talmidim of Rav Aharon Zatzal. We thank him very much for sharing this evening.
Firstly, I just want to say it's very appropriate that this evening really is taking place on this particular date. I don't know if anybody else is aware, but this is also Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal's birthday. It was on Yom Yerushalayim, which I always thought was extremely appropriate. Of course, the main theme of Yerushalayim is the theme of Ir Shechubra LaYachdav, the idea of a certain integrated collectivity which recognizes the diversity of Klal Yisrael on the one hand, but also understands that it's possible to integrate, and that integration is more than the sum of its parts, and is the ultimate goal, which enhances the significance of the variety that characterizes Klal Yisrael. I always thought that the fact that Yom Yerushalayim came later, but that you know, confluence or convergence took place was something that was really a kind of hashgacha. This week's parsha, Baharim B'chukosai, the second parsha, B'chukosai, begins, as we all know, with a very quixotic pasuk. In B'chukosai, Selechu, V'es Mitzvasai, Tishmoru, V'asisa Mosam. And of course, the simple reading of the pasuk is that we're referring here to chukim. We all know that there are different divisions, different genres in the Torah. We're all familiar with the difference between chukim and mishpatim. Chukim represents certain mitzvos which are intellectually more challenging. We may say that they have an inner logic, but at the same time, certainly they belong to the world of shmiras ha-mitzvos. But Rashi, of course, quotes the famous words of the Torah's Kohanim that suggest that in b'chukosai telechu refers not to shmiras ha-mitzvos at all, but to the immersion in Talmud Torah. Yochol zeh kiyum ha-mitzvos u'kesh'omer, the next part of the pasuk, v'es mitzvosai tishmoru, harei kiyum ha-mitzvos amur, hamani mekayim in b'chukosai telechu, shetiyu amelim b'torah. This is the obligation to be a melim b'Torah. This is a well-known expression. Even Tinokos Shel Beis Rabban are familiar with the idea of a melus b'Torah. In recent times, like everything else, they've put it to music. We all know this phrase, but translating it is extremely challenging. What really is a melus b'Torah? It's one of those almost ineffable terms that Chazal use that too are more than the sum of its parts. Certainly, it refers to toil and perseverance. That has to be the beginning. But if that's all that it was, it certainly would be inadequate and certainly wouldn't justify the connection to chukim, whatever that is, and the fact that this precedes and really defines the connecting relationship with shmiras ha-mitzvos. Toil and perseverance are indispensable steps, but certainly they're not a goal in and of their own right. Probably a better translation for amelus is the idea of total immersion, an absolute and holistic commitment to Torah, intellectually, but especially experientially, and a translation of that into the next part of the pasuk, Shmiras HaMitzvos. Rashi himself continues, Anvim Mitzvosai Tishmaru, Hevu Amelim Batorah, he repeats again, Almanas Lishmar Ulekayim, Kemoshe Nemar, V'limaritem Osam, V'shmartem Lasosam. In the Sifra itself, it adds that a person who is involved in Lilmot Shalom and Aslasos, Noach Shelo Nivra, extremely, very problematic in a way, indictment of such an individual. Better he not be born than that he be immersed in Torah, but not for the purpose of fulfilling the mitzvahs. And the question is, again, why the centrality of this idea of a melus, its ambiguity, its multiple meanings, this inverted connection with Shmiras HaMitzvos, why the connection to Chukim, and why the Chukosai plural as well? I always thought, not just in the last almost month, but always from the time that Zachisi, I merited to be a Talmud of Mori V'Rabi, of Aaron Lichtenstein, Zechorno Livracha, almost from the first day, that the epitome of a melus batorah, in all of its multiple meanings, really was embodied, by his persona in every sense. Of course, it begins as a quantitative idea, with effort, toil, the perseverance that we spoke of before. But it's important to understand that perseverance and effort, as I said before, have to be wedded with something much more. The Mishnah Novos tells us, and the Rambam in Perek Gimel of Hilchos Talmud Torah codifies this, that becoming a Talmud Chacham, the goal of learning is to be involved in the Keser of Torah, which is Ola al Gabeyem, which is even more impressive than the Keser of Malchus and the Keser of Kahuna. One might have thought that the Amol part and the Malchus part were two completely different aspects. We don't normally associate nobility, a regal bearing, Malchus, which a Talmud Chacham, a true Talmud Chacham, really achieves, Man Malchi Rabbanon. We don't associate that with hard work and perseverance per se and effort. But that really, Kachi Darka Shel Torah, is what's unique about Torah. The democratic character of the Keser Torah, something with Shrav Lichtenstein really embodied. You heard numerous stories before about his humility, about his the way that he related to every and all Jews, the way that he conducted and just his general bearing, his personal bearing, on the one hand was democratic, and on the other hand was the embodiment, because of its democracy, because of its roots in toil and in perseverance, in Man Malchi Rabbana. The Rambam himself, in Perek Gimel of Hilchos Talmud Torah Halacha Zayin, integrates these two ideas. Shema Tomar Ad She'akabes Mamon, before that, Mishin Es'o Libo L'kayim Mitzvah Zu, the Mitzvah of Talmud Torah Kira'ui, V'lios Muchtar B'kisra Shel Torah, and to achieve the crown of Torah, to be Man Malchi Rabbana, Lo Yasiach Daikel L'dvar Macherim, The Rambam integrates as one the concept of a melus batorah and the keser Torah. And the question is, how does that happen? It begins, I said, with toil and with perseverance. Rabbi Hochberg described Rav Lichtenstein preparing for a shir or learning on his own. I never saw the self-chavrusa part, but anybody who was zocha to be a Talmud of Rav Lichtenstein, whether it was here in New York or in Alon Shvut, in Yeshivat HaRatzion, would never forget the picture of him sitting at his table and the pure toil and perseverance and hard work that was written on his brow, in his face. Again, he would sit there. I didn't see the standing and the walking, you know, with two different people, but talking to himself, formulating things, being doche, being refining. That effort was really something that was inimitable and something which was unforgettable. Rav Lichtenstein prepared for every single shir. Remember, he was once telling me that he was working on a sefer, which I understand is soon to come out, and that, you know, it had fallen behind schedule, and that some of his family members were a little critical about that, which I certainly can understand. And he said, I tried to explain to them, tomorrow's shiur always comes first. And this was a statement which didn't surprise me in the least. To know Rav Lichtenstein is to know that no matter how many times he learned the sugya again before he publicly gave any shiurim, out of respect for the material, out of respect for the audience, given the possibility that maybe he'd find a new nofech, some other element to define, to develop. His love for learning, his chavivas haTorah, and his respect for the material were such, that was part of the amelus, the toil, and the perseverance that every shiur had to be prepared for. That, notwithstanding a prodigious memory, the fact that all of his shiurim were really worked through in such a way, in terms of their rigor, in terms of their scope and their range, that likely conclusions were not going to change, certainly not radically. But that was part of the amelus shel Torah. I think it simply would have been inconceivable to him not to prepare for every single shiur. The actual presentation of the shiur reflected that amelus as well. Again, you could see the hard work just visually, I don't think intentionally, but you could see him grinding through the topics, really thinking as he was formulating it. Again, a sense that this is the most important thing that anyone could be doing. In this sense, the merging of amelus as toil and perseverance together with amelus as pure immersion. The methodology of his teaching, this is something to speak about at another occasion, reflected not only his Yiras Shamayim, but again, the sense of amelus in a maximal way as well. He didn't take the easy way out. Everything was done with a structure, an a priori structure that preceded the material that was being analyzed, a methodological focus. Again, almost the march through Shas, sugya after sugya after sugya, the regular yeshiva mesechtas, and special shiurim in Zroim and in Taros and in Kadshim. The Amelus Shebet Torah was absolutely incredible. But, as I say, it wasn't just hard work, and certainly wasn't just quantitative. It was where quantity really redefined quality. Singular insight on the basis of all of this amelus, seeing the entire totality of the Shas as one. We used to joke sometimes, Rav Lichtenstein used to carry his Shas around with him whenever he'd go to a shiur. Rabbi Berman mentioned before that you know, it was hard to get him to allow you to carry a suitcase. I also had that experience now and then. You couldn't get him to you know, to allow you to carry his Shas either. But he used to drag this Shas around, and people used to joke that it's, you know, Ashrei Mi Shaba, you know, the Talmudo B'yado. But literally, the Shiurim, both in preparation and the giving of the Shiur, the focus of the Shiur was really Shas-oriented. It really took in the full range, not only of the possibilities, but of the possibilities that presented themselves from the looking of the topic beyond the topic to the parallel topics to the bigger picture, again, more than the sum of its parts. And that is something which required credible mastery of the material, which of course stemmed from, radiated out of the toil and the perseverance, but especially had to be put together by a special intellect, but by a special neshama even more so, by means of that sense of total immersion, the other meaning of amelus. Rav Lichtenstein used to like to quote very much the Rambam's formulation in Sefer HaMitzvos about Avas Hashem, where the Rambam explains that a person who's really Ohev Hashem, a person who loves the Ribono Shel Olam, is somebody whose excitement and whose intensity flows over enthusiastically into the way that he presents the material and presents himself and presents the Ribono Shel Olam to others. Avraham Ohavi is, of course, the paradigmatic example Avram Megayeres Hanashim, Sarah Megayeres Hanashim, that sense of enthusiasm and exuberance. Rav Lichtenstein, as a person, was much more reticent and reserved. You had to know him to understand his exuberance and his excitement. But that amelus, that inability to leave any corner that, you know, might produce evidence of Dvar Hashem, a perspective, a wider view, a connection, that was his enthusiasm. That was his Avraham Ohavi moment. That was the spillover of the enthusiasm of being a true Amel Batorah. And this, of course, led to the next element, the next dimension, and that is the Man Malki Rabbanan, the Kisra Shel Torah, as the Rambam explains in Perek Gimel, Halacha Zayin. In fact, Rambam goes on to explain, based again on the Mishnah and Avos, but with his own twist, if a person says, L'kishe'efne eshne, when I have time, I'll learn Torah. But meanwhile, there are other things that I have to be doing, not other spiritual things, but other human things. Such an individual, says the Rambam, will never be zoche to the keser of Torah. It's a fascinating Rambam. The Rambam went beyond the Mishnah in Avos. One could have said that if a person is going to leave to chance his development as a Talmud Chacham, then there's a chance that he won't achieve Kisra Shel Torah. If you want to guarantee, if you want to secure that result, then it's necessary to exclude any kind of risk when it comes to attaining the goal. But the Rambam says much more than that. The Rambam says anybody who puts this goal at risk for sure cannot attain the goal and the crown. The crown of Torah is directly connected, as I say, radiates out of the sense of amelus and the sense of yegia. And if a person gives up on the latter, he'll never achieve the former. Rav Lichtenstein, Man Malki Rabbanan, was somebody who, as alluded to before, was extremely accessible from his point of view, but in some cases, many Talmidim felt a certain reserve or reticence, felt it difficult to waste his time, found it formidable to approach him. And the reason, I think, is because of this Man Malki Rabbanan. Didn't want to disappoint him. I think it was said before, you didn't want to formulate your question, you know, unintelligently, not only because he'd analyze it, but also because the way that he perceived you mattered. It was a sense that, despite his democratic nature and his empathy and his humanity, all of which were described here so beautifully before, in the end of the day, that is the prescription, that is the formula for Man Malki Rabbanan. But in the presence of somebody who is truly great and stands for things and is immersed in what he believes in, and is an Avraham Ohavi reflected by that enthusiasm and the effort and the investment that he puts in it, you don't want to waste that person's time. You don't want him to be disappointed in your, not only intelligence, but especially in your spiritual quotient, etc. Therefore, while he was certainly accessible, and I have to say that on a personal level, I have tremendous hakaras hatov, all the years from the very first day that I was a Talmud, Lichtenstein was extremely generous with his time and with his encouragement. It had a tremendous transforming impact on my life, and this is true for hundreds and hundreds of other Talmidim. But at the same time, there was this recognition that Man Malki Rabbanan, that here was somebody who was of nobility, regal, in the finest and best sense of that word. The second Rashi also reflects his unique and singular characteristic. The idea that there would be a Melos Shabbatorah which would only be applied intellectually and would not be extended to the world of mitzvos and avodas Hashem, to use the Sifra's much sharper indictment, Noach Shelo Haya Nivra. The contradiction to the very notion of both the toil and the perseverance, as well as the immersion of a melus b'Torah. Rav Lichtenstein, in one respect, was an extremely complicated person. I would say, probably inaccurately, he was an extremely complicated thinker. He had range, the ability to master many, many disciplines. His range, his ability to integrate them, was really something that was singular and maybe even unmatched. But at the same time, he was really a very simple Oved Hashem. The Rav Zatzal used to speak about this a lot. He spoke about it in terms of Reb Chaim and Reb Moshe. I'm sure it was true about himself as well. A certain emuna pshuta that really prevailed among these great intellects, sophisticated Talmid Chachamim, whose capacity to formulate the most adin, the most subtle kind of distinctions on the one hand, was wedded with a certain simple and basic belief in the Ribbono Shel Olam and sense of themselves as Ovdei Hashem. This is something that was certainly true of Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal. He was somebody who, on the one hand, had all this range and scope, but at the same time understood where the red lines were, and Rabbi Hochberg made allusions to that, and it's very important to understand. He was extremely sharp and extremely principled about things which he felt were a corruption of Torah. At the same time that he was able to master and to balance all of these different disciplines, his root was an amelus b'Torah in that respect as well. Therefore, the idea that there could be a limud haTorah, which is shelo minas lasos, that dissonance, that compartmentalization, anything other than a full integration and the integrity both of the learning and the avodas Hashem, was something that was anathema to him as well. I would say that Rav Lichtenstein, as a person, represented and embodied amelus. He was a persona of amelus in that respect. And finally, that's also the theme of in b'chukosai telechu, both its plural as well as its connection to chukim. We identify chukim with the part of Torah which requires emuna on the one hand, and also which pushes us to develop an inner logic, a sense of the coherence of all aspects of Torah and how they come together. We don't simply understand Torah right against the background of other cultures. Ibn Chukosai Telechu tells us that the Torah is what defines and determines. A person really wants to be an Isha Halacha, and someone who's a Melus, who's Yira, who's Yigiya, is going to create in this world of Torah. It has to begin with an appreciation for chukim. But not only chukim, but as the Or HaChaim explains, in b'chukosai telechu, multiple chukim. An appreciation of the range of Torah, its complexity on the one hand, but also that kula miroa echad nitnu, its harmony and its unity at the same time. And in that sense, again, ashreinu, zachinu, we are all tremendously privileged to know somebody who embodied a melus immersion in that sense as well. Somebody who was complex or complicated in his thinking, but who was consistent and had full integrity in his emuna and in his avodas Hashem. Somebody who could appreciate the range and also at the same time identify and be driven by the unity. Therefore, as we approach the Shloshim, certainly Rabbi Penner referred to the Gemara's discussion of Shloshim. It's absolutely true. The Hespedim of a great man can be even mentioned on a Rosh Chodesh precisely because they are Talmud Torah. But it's the Talmud Torah which leads to a reinforcement of the concept of Amelus, which also leads to Man Malchi Rabbanan on the one hand, and continued devotion to Avodas Hashem on the other. So as we move towards a different phase, certainly it's not the end of Hespedim, but further opportunity for us to rededicate to the themes of Amelus and everything that it implies, that is so much a part of the legacy of Moreinu v'Rabbeinu Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal. Thank you.
Just express my thanks again to the Rosenzweig, Rabbi Berman, Rabbi Penner, Rabbi Schoenfeld, all of you for coming. Chazal tell us, Ein nosim nefashos latzadikim, maaseim heinen zichronam. We don't make monuments, so to speak, for tzadikim, maaseihem, their actions are the zichronam, are their memory. And I would point out that maaseihem can also be embodied in each and every one of us. What we take from what we learned tonight, what we take from what we learned from Lichtenstein over the years. There are many things to read, many things to learn, and Zechusa Yogan Aleinu, it should be his Zikaron, he should be a male teacher for all of us.